Blog Talk Radio.
Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis, Chuck Thurston, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
Morning.
Good morning,
Paula.
Hi, Andre, Chuck.
Good morning, everyone.
We have something special today, which I've been looking forward to quite a bit. And with us on the phone right now is a dear friend and fellow student of the Arantia book, longtime reader, and the study group attendee with Andre and I, Mr. Mike Butler. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show. So great to have you.
Good morning, and thank you. Yeah, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
So good to have you.
Good to have you.
Well, Mike is a career police officer for many years, the chief of police in Longmont, Colorado, chief of public safety. After that, you can tell us more about your career, Mike. I don't want to mess it up, but I just think it's amazing that, having my dad was a police officer in Denver for 30 years, and I happen to know that it's a very hard job. And it's very tense and difficult. And I knew my dad died at the age of 59 of a heart attack, and I since learned that many police officers die of heart attacks, and, it's just such a stressful job. So I say this only because I want to express to you how grateful I am for your service, and I know personally how hard it can be, and also I admire you so much for pioneering in Longmont this idea of restorative justice and new ways of keeping the public safe and new ways of healing and restoring, criminals, too. I know you have such a heart for that. So thank you so much. And maybe you can start by telling us about yourself, telling a little about your history and how you found the Arantia book, maybe. And
sure.
Well,
thank
your journey.
You for that. Thank you for the introduction, Paula.
Sure.
I'll start off with I raised 5 daughters, and they're women of the world. 3 of them
girl
have
dad.
Married men. I'm sorry. 3 of them have married women from. I'm sorry, men from other countries. And I have 5 grandchildren that have citizenship in at least 2 countries.
Wow.
And so I'm most proud of the fact that my daughters have become, in their own way, women of the world. They're in their own kind of realm of idealism. They want to change the world, and they're raising planetary citizens. We all know that that's where it's all headed in terms of the blending and the unification of the whole planet eventually. But I'm just proud that three of my daughters kind of went off into that direction. So that
congratulations, Mike.
My career, it was in public safety. I started off with the FBI years ago. That was such a non-personal job. You served the United States of America, and that sounds interesting, but there was very little personal about it. And so I switched over to local policing and basically worked in Boulder for 15-plus years, worked way up to the number 2 position, then became the chief of police in Longmont, and eventually began to oversee public safety, which was police, fire, and some other social services, and along the way had the opportunity and privilege to kind of rethink, reset, recalibrate what we did in public safety in a way that was more effective. There's no question that it was more effective. It shows up for those proof in the pudding folks out there. It showed up in bottom line numbers around the amount of crime, the number of issues that we had with gangs, the domestic violence, the lethal domestic violence, they diminished dramatically over the years. And I was also blessed with a wonderful, wonderful staff of really sincere and with a high level of conviction public servants. So anyway, I know the program this morning is about restorative justice, and that's fine. And I may refer to it as restorative principles, practices, and justice, because there's kind of a traditional way of seeing restorative justice. But I also know that the restorative principles can apply to a number of different circumstances in our communities and our lives. And so there's my introduction.
Bravo. And you know, I hope we can keep it broad, too, to include, you know, your entire experience. Because not just in restorative justice, but in criminal justice and in trying to keep the public safe. And you mentioned some of the challenges. And I often think, wow, you know what? My dad tried to talk me into being a police officer. And I told him, Dad, I don't think I could do that. And I fully appreciate
Officer Paula has a nice ring to it.
I don't know. I was, he was all completely sincere, too. And I'm like, I just don't know if I could do that. I just don't know. It's really a tough job. And, go ahead, Marvin.
Well, I just, when Paula mentioned, Mike, that you were going to be coming on the program and what the topic was, I felt myself sort of respond just with excitement. I just think it's such an important theme. And I think the whole theme, and I'd love to hear any of your thoughts you've had around the spiritual meaning, significance of restoration. You know, and how it plays out in the Urantia book, and in a larger sense, how the inspiration of restoring people to a place of dignity and a place of good function and a place of being feeling loved and valued, just how that plays out spiritually for you and what it's meant for you as well in your work. If you have thoughts along those lines, it'd be great to hear some of that as well. I'm sure you've thought about these things.
Thanks, Marvin.
Yeah.
This is something I enjoy talking about. the restorative principles, in my mind, are gifts of the Spirit. And what's so wonderful about the gifts of the Spirit is that they exist so abundantly in our midst. And part of our invitation, I think, is to kind of recognize, harness, and utilize those gifts of the Spirit for the good of our fellow women and men. And restorative justice is a mechanism that I think serves as a kind of a harnessing apparatus to bring those gifts of the Spirit to life. And my take is we could do this. We could take the gifts of the Spirit and the fruits of the Spirit and kind of redo our institutions with those in mind. And when we talk about restorative justice, we're also kind of talking about something that has everything to do with the criminal justice system, but in a different way. The principles of apology, forgiveness, relationship, these principles heal. They bring life and love to relationships. They're the fertile soil where, apology and forgiveness are cultivated. They serve to mend and heal harm. They're the goodness that replaces what we know as evil on our planet. They very much enhance a personal sense of belonging for people. And in terms of a community, they're the fibers that they're pretty strong fibers that can weave a healthy social fabric. And that's my take on the entire police profession. We have a million police officers in this country, thereabouts. And a large part of my work since I was doing this before I left, but since I left and talking to police chiefs, police departments, mayors, elected officials all over the country is that we could actually, the police can play a role of identifying the goodness that's in our communities. And that may sound a little bit, well, where are you coming from with that? Because their role is to enforce the law. Well, that is a role that we play, or the police play, there's no question. But I also know that the police are, they're a 24/7 operation, and they are integrated into our communities more than just about anybody else, any institution that exists within our communities. And so there is a way for the platform is so legitimate for police to do that. And then to also what I refer to as surface and activate the gifts, the talents, the skills, resource, expertise, we might refer to that as social capital in our community. And I know this can happen because we did it longer. And everything's an economy of scale. We're only 100,000 people here. But the role that the police began to play over the years was just that. And so there was a lot of things that needed to happen to kind of shift and change the culture of a police department, the nature of how we define justice in a community, away from exacting a pound of flesh, more towards this idea within restorative justice that people can safely choose accountability and be responsible, that someone who's been harmed by the crime, their voice becomes a centerpiece in terms of what is going on. And you may or may not be aware of this, but there's no legal provision for a victim's voice inside the criminal justice system. And then on top of that, the community has great influence on the outcome of these cases. But when we go back and look at what the role of police can play, that's another thing that we're not going to talk about a lot today, but the principles utilized are restored. And in my mind, they are gifts and fruits of the Spirit. In terms of because the police run across a lot of folks who have the worst day of their lives. And they also encounter people who have hurt others, who have harmed others, who have violated our codes and our laws. And how we treat those people and how we are with those people can mean a great deal to that person's future and even the health of a community. If we continually go out and kind of arrest and invoke the criminal justice system for those folks who are, for instance, struggling with addiction or struggling with their mental health and they commit crimes, and we go out and invoke the criminal justice system, you know, their chances of finding a job, their chances of finding housing, diminish dramatically that kind of action. But there are other ways of working with people outside of invoking a criminal justice system. And one of the things that I'm encouraging police departments everywhere to consider is to kind of disassociate not altogether, from the criminal justice system and associate more with kind of those gifts of the spirit in the heart of our community, heart of our communities. And there are ways, there are templates, including restorative justice, but definitely the principles of restorative justice, in which you can develop these kind of harnessing apparatuses, these mechanisms, and apply them for the good of the whole. And so there's a lot to this in terms of how a police department can be, and it can still very much maintain its role as enforcer. And, you know, but the idea is to do it more selectively. The idea is to do it more judiciously, to be more focused and precise and less one size fits all. So I've said a lot right there, and I'll throw it back to you guys if you have any questions or thoughts. So.
Well, I have a lot of questions and thoughts. I don't want to dominate because I want these guys to be able to ask you questions too. But I just want to say that in my experience as a child, my dad being a policeman, and policemen were heroes. And there wasn't this community enmity between the police and the community. And I was so proud that my dad was a policeman. And I remember he drove a squad car for 20 years, and he walked a beat. You know, it wasn't just driving the car. It was getting out and walking the beat. And that was really typical in the 60s. And all of the business owners up and down, you know, the various streets that he walked knew him. And they could pop their head out and say, "Dick, come here," you know, and he would come in and help them with something, you know, that was going on. Maybe it's a bar. There was a bar called Procopio's, and John Procopio became a good friend of my father's. And they had such a relationship, the business community, with the cop on the beat. And they trusted the cop, and they knew the cop was there just right at hand. And it seems like it changed at some point where it was 100% in squad cars, and the cop, you know, they were just in too much danger is what I understood. But it took something away of that personal, you know, and it was you mentioning that you left the FBI because you wanted to be in personal contact. And that speaks to me of ministry. That's real ministry. And I know my dad, he was like that. He really did want to serve and protect. That was what he was about. And you're right. He would go in and with people who were in the worst day of their life. Many times it was a dispute between a couple, and they were in a big fight. And it wasn't, you know, necessary back then for him to arrest the man. He got very skilled at just calming the whole situation down and restoring right there on the scene, restoring whatever semblance of order there was. And arrest was like the last resort. And it seems like they've tied, you know, they truly are ministers. Many policemen are ministers in their heart. They're there to protect. They want to help. And they've tied their hands. The laws, various laws have tied their hands, and they can't really do what, you know, they want to do. And it's put them at enmity with the community. And it's sad because you shouldn't be afraid when police come. You should be comforted and glad. They're there to help. and protect you. And
What's happened?
Go ahead.
Try to explain a little bit of where was your dad a police officer, by the way?
In Denver. He came to Colorado when he was three, and so but
beautiful.
After he got out of World War II, then he became a police officer in Denver.
So there's the metamorphosis, and I won't go into all of this, but what happened over the decades is that we began to, as what I'll characterize as criminalize our woundedness, and believe that as things got more complex, things got more serious, there was more of certain kinds of crimes. Elected officials get tough on crime, three strikes and you're out. You know, their political platforms were, I'm going to arrest all the criminals. Well, guess who's the arm of the government is that's going to do that? That's the police. And so as we criminalized our woundedness and as we passed more laws and stiffened up penalties and thinking that by doing that we could kind of legislate our future or perhaps create an insurance policy that might protect us from the human condition, we ended up depersonalizing. The police ended up depersonalizing themselves and in essence became faceless entities within our communities. And along with that, police chiefs say to people in their communities, if you need us, call us for anything. And what that developed in a large way was a real unhealthy dependency to the point where, you know, and the communities took police up on that, by the way, and to the point where a large percentage of the calls for service that are responded to with a police car didn't have a crime attached to them. But I agree with you in terms of the absolute personalization of what is happening with police. That's been lost. It was lost. And it still is to a great degree all over this country. And so the very much police departments are faceless entities that kind of live inside these fortresses and kind of drive in and out of their buildings with police cars and respond to the citizen issue with a squad car. That's a very short, brief version of part of what happened and that caused the police to kind of become what they refer to as a lot more professional and a lot less personal and took away that cop on the beat aspect of policing. So you're right. That's what occurred.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about this, Mike. And I got to say, I'm so impressed with the breadth and the depth of your sort of exposure to these issues. And you know, being a reader of the book, I think you're probably equipped in additional ways to attempt to address that actually out in the culture, which I think is extremely challenging. I was just thinking while you and Paula were talking about several episodes that are related in the book, in the Urantia book. One was the, you know, mentioning domestic
right.
issues and the situation with Jesus when he approaches the man in the harbor who's berating his wife and sort of abusing his wife in public and how he intervenes and how he assumes the best intention on the part of that individual and mentions it and calls it out and puts it right in front of him and gives him a choice to repent, to turn back and to come around to a spiritually inspired. That's one episode. The other is the parable of the lost son, the prodigal son, you know, and how much the father rejoices at the son who has been out and wandering in the world in confusion. And I think for many people that come into the criminal justice system, that's an apt metaphor. They've gotten confused, misled, made poor choices, and are really they're demoralized at their ability to find a way back into a higher function. And then the last thing that occurred to me was when you were talking about the projection of our own, what would you call it? Evil is probably the appropriate word, you know, in the sense that the Orange Book talks about error and evil as almost synonymous and different from
right.
sin and iniquity. When Jesus says to the accusers of the woman caught in adultery, he says, "Who among you is without sin? Let that person cast the first stone." So, I mean, the issue around restorative justice is every one of us. I don't know any of us that hasn't made errors that we wish we would have made, you know. And if we could rectify them, you know, we would like to. The issue is, I think some people in society get caught in this vicious situation where they can't, and society won't let them turn around and won't encourage them or show them a way. But I think having made errors is a universal experience. But people project that onto others and avoid dealing with it in themselves and avoid asking themselves the question, how would I like to be treated if I had gone wrong and been in this person's situation? Which is, of course, the essence of the golden rule. So I think there's lots in the book that relates to this. But I had a question, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on
sure.
it. I mean, you and I have talked about this kind of thing before, that there are different cultures that we all operate in. And as I think about restorative justice, one of the cultures is the police culture itself, in the profession and among the leadership. And, you know, you're out there trying to change perspectives, trying to change minds and show people a better way. I'm curious what you encounter in the actual cultures of the police community around this, and I'm sure there's division. But there's the police culture, there's the community culture and how to uplift that, and then there's the culture as a whole. And I'd just love to hear if, you know, you've been out there in the trenches, what you're encountering and what the challenges are and how you go about trying to speak to those challenges of sort of a little bit closed minds and myopic, you know, points of view. I'd love to hear some of your experiences around all of that.
Yeah, and thank you for what you just said, too, Marvin. So let me just kind of go back to this idea of how we've defined justice over the years. And, you know, when there's a victim of a crime and the media is around and they stick a microphone in someone's face and they say, "What do you want?" And they say, "I want justice." And typically what that means is they want a pound of flesh. They want an eye for an eye. It's very retributive and punitive in its nature. And by the way, as we try to transform police, and I'm going to throw this part out there, as we try to transform police transformation, we can't utilize the same kind of dynamics and processes and modalities that we use to try to change communities from a very punitive perspective. That's the approach right now. There's been 2,000 bills passed by, or at least introduced by the states, by 50 states all over the country, and most of those are very punitive in their orientation towards police. And if we get time to talk about another change model to make that work, that's fine. But when I speak to people who are kind of enslaved by tradition, I guess. I ask them in so many words, "How's this working for you?" Because we know study after study that shows that the recidivism rates can be upwards of 70-80%. And we did a study, and so here's the example I use. We did a study here in Longmont a few years ago, which we looked at a number of people that, and it was a number of years ago that we arrested people for crimes of breaking into houses, breaking into cars, breaking into, or vandalism. And when we went back and looked at their criminal history record, we found that on average each of those people had been arrested 9 times prior to that year.
Wow.
And it had 16 charges. And every police officer knows that that's not atypical. But then I asked him, I said, would you take your car to the same mechanic 9 times or a 10th time to try to get it fixed if they weren't fixing it all those previous other times? None of us live our lives. None of us live our lives that way. Well, at least I hope not, in terms of saying, okay, well, I'm going to try it a 10th time. Because, I mean, you get into, Einstein's definition of insanity. And so recidivism rates are high. The revolving door of people going in and out of the system are high. And by the way, when they come back out, each one of those times, someone else has been re-victimized. There's a really good chance that someone else has been hurt when that happens. And so my question for people is there something else we can do? Should there be something else we can do? Should we be asking the question, should we be doing something else? Or are you going to continue to take your car to that same mechanic? And they all know that that's the deal. They all know that that's part of what's happening. And so the whole idea of fear, retribution, has defined a lot of what goes on in our communities. And as we well know, I don't want to get into some of the, how the media kind of stirs the pot a little bit, but, there is a lot of marketing of fear, marketing of fault, exploiting our wounds, wounds of people, wounds of the community, and at some level, just generally dramatizing the human condition. And so there's a lot of fear-based decisions being made in our communities, whether they're by governments, police departments, people in general in our communities. And there's a high level still of disconnectedness and isolation in our communities. And that's where I believe the police can play a significant role in terms of mending the social fabric or building or making it stronger. And that has everything to do with what restorative principles are, by the way. When I talk to other police chiefs or mayors or elected officials or police departments in general, I make it clear that, we have to reconsider the role that we're playing, that what the potential is we can do. And by the way, for a while there was a great window of opportunity. It was right after George Floyd in Minneapolis, and at one point right after Ferguson that occurred in July of 2014, in which police departments and mayors and police chiefs and sheriffs were much more open to hearing various perspectives. And by the way, the whole restorative justice perspective is still now being sought after by police departments in terms of how to make it work all over the country. I just got back from Idaho, where I spoke to 45 police chiefs for a full day about a lot of this. I'm having a conversation with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department command staff in January. And there's been others that these are just the two recent ones. There are others that there is a an attractiveness to restorative justice that there wasn't before. And so there's more hope out there, I think. But I also believe, I'm going over some of this stuff real quickly in terms of the role police can play in terms of generating social capital or creating a sense of belonging in a community or identifying what's good in the community and leveraging that. And by the way, that's a major principle in restorative justice, and that is letting someone know that has committed a harm, that has committed a crime, that they're not going to be that's not how they're going to be identified. And there's a lot of work done on the front end to say, what are your gifts? What are your strengths? And we really, the idea of reflecting back someone's goodness is a much more powerful and sustaining force within somebody than shaming them or to try to make them feel guilty. And that's what happens when people go into the criminal justice system and they're arrested. They do feel a level of shame. They do feel a level of guilt. And you know, maybe some small levels of that are fine, but then they are pounded into the ground by the system itself. And then they are somewhat isolated and excommunicated when they come back into the community, either by families, friends. Sometimes they lose their jobs, they lose their families, they lose their spouses. A lot of those things happen, and then you have an entirely different set of dynamics going on inside of somebody, and that's kind of versus, hey, here's what we want you to do. We want you to safely choose accountability. We want you to understand that we don't want this one event to define who you are, and we want you to be able to reintegrate back into our community, and we're going to help you do that. And just to give you some set of numbers, over the years, Longmont's referred 7,000 cases to restorative justice versus in lieu of arrest. And the rate of crime in this community, because recidivism rates are so low with restorative justice, less than 7%, satisfaction rates on the part of people who we characterize as victims is upwards near 98%. And how that plays out in terms of, as you mentioned at the beginning of this program, Paula, how does that play out with safety? When we had 60,000 people in this community, we had 5,000 Part 1 crimes. And I'm not going to give all the credit to restorative practices, but I'm going to give definitely a chunk of it to restorative practices. Now that we're 100,000 people, we have 3,100 Part 1 crimes. We had 450 gang members in this community at one point. We're down to less than 70. We were averaging 2 to 3 women die a year as a result of domestic violence. And over the last 20 years, we've only had 2 women die. Still too many. But a lot of this has been a factor and a residual of how we've been working with people. And so the ultimate bottom line for police departments is what I let them know is, how effective do you want to be? And do you want to reduce race? Do you want to make your community safer? Do you want the community to trust and you want to have a better relationship with them? And so all those things are, of course, yes. The answers to that are yes. And so, well, here's what's been going on till now. And now here's another way of doing business that can maybe help you down that path of becoming more effective. So anyway, everything I'm talking about here, there's a lot of information behind it all. There's a lot of data and there's a lot of research to support some of this. And so how's that? I'll leave that there.
When you talk about 7,000 cases were referred, can you kind of describe to us exactly what happens when you refer a case and what happens next and what the whole process of restorative justice is?
Yeah. So let me just say that these cases involve kids, they involve adults, they involve misdemeanors, they involve felonies, they involve first-time offenders, they involve multiple offenders. People have been through the system multiple times. And the track record of 7% recidivism, less than 7%, sustains itself in all those groups. But here's the person that defers or refers a case, a certain set of circumstances, to the restorative justice process is the police officer. They're trained in terms of how to do that. They have the option to arrest. They have the option to issue a citation. But that we've given them many more options, and that's part of what I let other police departments know about, is that we need more options to deal with the messiness of the human condition, if you will. And the one-size-fits-all approach is what's causing a lot of the recidivism. And so what happens is if they refer to restorative justice, there is a nonprofit. The infrastructure can look a lot of different ways, but in Longmont, there's a nonprofit. And they provide the restorative practice services They get the names of everyone that the police officer encountered, the person that was victimized by a crime, the person that committed the harm, the offense. And we purposely, when we began this process, by the way, we purposely wanted the, our enrollment, we wanted restorative justice to not be under the auspices of the local government. We wanted it to be community activated, community run. So the vast majority of what happens in restorative justice in Longmont is done by other members, other citizens in the community. They're not done by professionals within the criminal justice system or service providers along those lines. And so, and that, by the way, really plays out when we say, listen, then as you mentioned, Marvin, the culture of the community still defines justice in many communities as exacting a pound of flesh. Our whole idea around the community culture was shifting the nature of justice so that it could be something that could be perceived as restorative. And so the more we had community engaged, the more likely that was to happen over time. And so once the case is referred to the restorative justice process, they're contacted, the victim, the offender, there's community members contacted. There's a lot of pre-conferencing interviewing. Then there's a conference put together. And then they work out within the auspices of that conference. They work out how is the harm going to be repaired, and there's actually a contract that the offender has to agree to, and oftentimes the consequences that are in this contract of things that this offender has to do are tied to the event, the circumstances that they were involved in. One example, there's several examples, but the one that comes to mind for me, first of all, is we had somebody that hit somebody in the head and caused lots of bleeding, and it was an assault. And fortunately, the person didn't have any brain damage, but the consequence was you had to go spend time with doctors and nurses that were working on head injuries, and to kind of see how that played out for people who were injured. And that was, those things were really impactful for people. And there were more to it. There were more things that they had to do. But there, those were things where the consequences are, as much as we can tie cause and effect together, we do. And so they have a contract. There's an amount of time they have to complete the contract. The victim, as I said before, their voice is a centerpiece. They get to talk about all the things that happened to them as a result of this crime, how they're feeling, their level of insecurity, their level of now they no longer feel safe. You know, when we've had some high school people involved with this, the peers from their high schools would come in and say, listen, you're impacting us as fellow adolescents because – You're out there committing a crime as an adolescent. Here's how this goes for us in terms of it's just like, well, these are just kids committing crimes. And so there's a lot of peer accountability going on as well as accountability. And so the offender, not only do they get to safely choose accountability, and by the way, that's versus within the criminal justice system, either having it legislated or demanded. And what we know is that when someone chooses accountability, it's more likely to sustain than if it's demanded or legislated and not chosen. And so the offender not only gets to choose accountability, but gets to realize the impact of their actions, not only with the victim, but with the community at large. And these conferences are facilitated by citizens. Train facilitators. We spend quite a bit of time training community members on how to facilitate these kinds of conferences in a way that can get to the kind of get to the results that we hope to get to. And so that's happened over 7,000 times in Longmont, and with recidivism rates, the recontact rates, and the recontact rate is up to 3 years, and it's not over the next 6 weeks or anything like that. And so we know that the person that committed the crime is now choosing accountability, is but walks away feeling good about themselves because they understand that they have gifts, they have talents, skills to offer our community, to offer others. We really spend a lot of time with people to let them know that this event isn't going to define you. And so it's restorative.
They have value. Yeah, they have value.
They're appreciated. It's restorative for the victim. It's restorative for the offender. And it's restorative for the community. And
okay, so
it's a triangle for that.
I just have a quick question, and then I want to open it up to Andre and Chuck, because I know I'm sure they have questions too. But you said that the officer has the ability to invoke that. Does he have to involve a judge, or can he literally do that himself?
Yes, we purpose. That's part of the deal. Part of what other police departments are a little wary of, how could we give police officer that kind of discretion? Well, they already have that kind of discretion in terms of what they can do. In terms of making arrests or doing nothing or issuing summonses. But, yes, we didn't want the offender to have to experience the criminal justice system at all, other than what the police officer's contact is about. And so that's where it ends. That's where the criminal justice system ends, and it really doesn't begin. So they don't see prosecutors, they don't see judges, they don't see anybody in parole or probation. They just see the police officer, and then they're called within a couple of weeks. Yeah. So
that's brilliant, because it takes pressure off of the whole criminal justice system. I mean, it's so overburdened, the courts and stuff. So I love that aspect of it. Well
it also,
Andre,
it also makes it just also makes the policeman, just briefly, the policeman an agent of rehabilitation instead of an agent of punishment. That's great.
Yeah.
We're heading in that direction. The kind of the bad guy, the heavyweight.
The enforcer.
There's a whole other genre of conversation to talk about police cultures in terms of how to shift them from where they're at to where we want them to be, but this you hit something, Marvin, in terms of if you can expose police officers to what can happen that's good in a community, or what's going on that's good in a community, that's part of the process of shifting the culture. So,
yeah, you allow them to begin to function as a hero instead of a villain, you know, in the community. Yeah.
Which they are, really. They're in the truest sense, they are heroes. They're willing to lay their life down to protect somebody. That's, by definition, a hero. And they do that all the time. So, Andre and Chuck, I want to open it up to you guys. I'm sure you have questions for Mike.
Well, what a rich conversation. It's wonderful to have you on talking about this. You know, Mike, I know that a lot of your viewpoint had to have been influenced by, you know, a long, long history with the Urantia book, and just essentially saying, you know, how do I weave this into, you know, what I have chosen as my life career? And, you know, what's interesting to me is, you know, in the Urantia book, when they talk about justice and righteousness, I mean, it comes up right away in paper number 2 as part of the nature of God. In section 3, They go on this way: the justice of the universal Father, and this is paragraphs 1 and 2. God is righteous, therefore is he just. The Lord is righteous in all his ways. I have not done without cause all that I have done, says the Lord. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. The justice of the universal Father cannot be influenced by the acts and performances of his creatures, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God. No respect of persons, no taking of gifts. That's a telling paragraph. But here's where it goes on and really dovetails right away with the whole idea of restorative justice. How futile to make puerile appeals to such a God to modify his changeless decrees so that we can avoid the just consequences of the operation of his wise natural laws and righteous spiritual mandates. Right there, it sounds like they're going in the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth mode. But Then they go on. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. True, even in the justice of reaping the harvest of wrongdoing, this divine justice is always tempered with, and that's always tempered with, mercy. Infinite wisdom is the eternal arbiter which determines the proportions of justice and mercy which shall be meted out in any given circumstance. And then it goes on. But, you know, the idea here to me is that there's this idea of the reactionary, I mean, it's a very good reaction. This is a positive reactionary aspect of restorative justice. It can act when a crime has been committed. But you've rightly presented the overarching concept of restorative practices and restorative principles, which apply to other realms, not just policing, not just the whole justice system. Do you want to speak about that and how some of that functions not only in the reactive sense, but how some of it is proactive and even preventative?
Well, so well said, Andre, and thanks for bringing that out in paper two. Yes, we've utilized a lot of it within our schools and pre-crime or amongst students being restorative. And we've utilized it in neighborhoods in terms of getting potentially conflicting neighbors to kind of rethink, you know, who their neighbor is and what they have to offer, and how, you know, if there was less antagonism and resentment and more sense of how we're going to make our neighborhood better together, I mean, that's much more fruitful. And so it can be worked out in relationships amongst friends and families. It can be worked out in business arrangements. We've seen that happen. We've actually facilitated some of those. And, you know, wow. For me, you talked about, you know, the Urantia Papers, its influence. You know, one of the basic sound principles and revelations that come out of the Urantia Papers and makes it so clear for us is that we all have a fragment of God within us. We all have that spark of the incident. Everybody does. The people who are victimized, the people who do the victimization, the offenders. And somehow, if we can reach that aspect, that part of that person, if we can talk and kind of have some influence on the higher part of who people are, there's no doubt in my mind that the sustainability of whether it's accountability or whether it's seeing the world differently or seeing, you know, who themselves differently, maybe mostly, is much greater in terms of the probability than saying, okay, we're going to shame you. We're going to arrest you. We're going to isolate you from the community. And so there is something, and that's one of those forces that's one of those gifts of the Spirit, I believe, that we can harness. And I keep on saying, you know, we have these gifts of the Spirit, and we have to figure out how to harness them and make structures and mechanisms that serve humanity. And all our institutions could be actually kind of begin that process of reconstructing themselves around that kind of thinking. You know, we're just doing that within the criminal justice system and within a police. But if we can do it here and we can do it with victims and offenders, we can do it just about anywhere. And because there's typically a lot more trauma, a lot more drama, a lot more pain and woundedness that comes with criminal behavior. And so that's a big part of it. And it does have universal applicability. And you can call it so many different things. We just happen to call it restorative. There's lots of reconciling that can go on. There's so many different things you can call it. But for us, it's just been the restorative model.
Yeah, in 12-step programs, they would call it making amends, wouldn't they?
Right.
As a significant part of it.
I think that's step 8 or step 9. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, pretty basic.
Yeah.
I got a couple of passages that relate to Jude and the whole situation with Jude and the family that I think are kind of relevant to this as well. But along with you, Paula, I just want to make sure if you've got any thoughts, or questions. Go ahead, and then I'll throw mine after. Yeah.
All right, great. Yeah, Mike, thanks for joining us today. Really enjoying the application, the bringing of wisdom into difficult situations.
Here.
It's quite a goal, really, and the way you're doing it, it just sounds marvelous. I did have a question, though. This whole restorative justice idea seems to assume that the perpetrator or the person, whoever it was that caused the harm, is apprehended. It's either apprehended or at least it's known who they are in order for that process to kick in. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about this. I guess it's sort of a social experiment that's been going on in some states, particularly in California, where I lived up until spring of 2020, where they're essentially decriminalized retail theft up to, I think, $950 now. It was a ballot initiative in 2014. And the result of this, what's that?
I am familiar with what you're talking about.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, you're not familiar. Oh, okay.
He is familiar.
Oh, you are familiar. Okay, great. Yeah. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that, where the police are refusing to apprehend, these sort of smash and grab, or even, you see these store videos, people just walk in with their big garbage bag and they just load it up to, around $900 and just walk out in broad daylight and nothing happens.
I got $954. I got $1 in the. So Chuck, let me just say, there are a lot of factors that went into making decisions like that, and
one of them,
Paul alluded to was the criminal justice system being overwhelmed. There's not a part of the criminal justice system that's not in triage mode, whether it's police saying this is what we can respond to and we can't respond to anything else, or whether it's the district attorney saying, well, out of 5,000 cases this year, we can only take 50 to trial because we don't have any more resources, or whether the court's saying, well, our dockets are 2 years long and what do we do now? And so every part of the criminal justice system is triaging because of the mode that we've been in terms of criminalizing all of our social and health issues or the residuals of those social and health issues. And so
like drug abuse, for instance,
like what,
like addiction, for instance,
example. That's definitely one of them in terms of someone in possession of an illicit narcotic, a Schedule II drug that's been defined as a illegal. And that's a felony in all 50 states. For decades, police were, that was the war on drugs. And, we've declared war on a lot of social issues. The obvious one is the one on drugs. And so because the system has been so overwhelmed, because the police are in triage mode in many cities, and because everybody else in the criminal justice system is in that mode, part of it is, and I've seen those numbers go from $50 to $100, to $200, to $400, to $600, to $1,000, and whatever. And so it's kind of like we begin characterizing these lesser crimes as something the criminal justice system doesn't want to deal with. But what we haven't done is put anything else in place, because there is harm done. If someone takes something that's worth $500, there is harm done, or vandalizes something that's worth $500. There's lots of harm done for people. Some people, I can tell you, have windows that have been broken out. It costs less than their deductible, but they couldn't afford to replace the window. And so what do you do in those circumstances? Well, with restoratively, we can, there's more responsibility. We actually can get people to help out with doing those things, including the offender and the offender's families quite often. Hmm. So it's a, that there's more factors and dynamics going on, Chuck, with that. What I believe is missing is an alternative or a substitute for why we're not doing anything for less than. And mm-hmm. and because you're right, people could play games. I mean, there are people who will manipulate and say, okay, well, if it's, the amount is $1,000, I'm going to go in for $750, and I'm untouchable. That's doesn't make sense to me,
yeah.
But I also understand why. Yeah, because they're up to their eyeballs in much more serious things. So,
mm-hmm. But if they're not apprehended in some way, then the restorative process you're talking about doesn't have an opportunity
right.
to function.
You're right, Chuck. The only way we can get someone has to say, I'm willing to admit accountability. And
right.
if the victim, in this case in Longmont, what we won't do is if the victim says no, or if the offender says, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment rights, I have the right to remain silent, well, then it has to go to the criminal justice system.
Mm.
But we've trained our officers on how to work people out of that kind of thinking because we let the victim know that they don't have a voice, that we don't know what will happen. It could take years. You may not get anything back as a result of going that way. It's easier to work with the offender because we say, hey, listen, you won't have a record. We won't arrest you. But here's what you're going to have to do. And there are consequences. But I won't call it the magic of the restorative justice system. I think it's the gifts of the spirit really begin to kick in that process in terms of how it impacts and motivates and inspires the people who have committed offenses or victims,
mm-hmm.
victims that have gone from incredibly angry at what happened and incredibly just, you know, bone shaking angry to acts of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many times we've seen that. And wanting to mentor somebody, victims going from hating somebody to wanting, those are gifts of the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And,
wow.
and anytime we can pull something like that off, those are the mechanisms that if you can harness these gifts in a way that can work that way, then you're much better off.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And what occurs to me about these, this, I guess you'd call it criminal activity where the perpetrators are not apprehended by the police because the police just, you know, they've sort of gotten a stand down order, I guess. These people with their bags full of stuff, I mean, they have to return to their communities. And that's a whole other interface. And I'm curious, and you may not have any way of knowing about this, have any information on this, but I'm curious how these people are received back into their communities. And there, you know, there's reports that this is even becoming organized. You know, like they'll organize a bunch of people. They'll all go out and strike simultaneously. But even so, they have to return to their communities with all this stuff, right? And how is that viewed within their community? I'm sure there must be some division of attitude about that. You know, maybe some people applaud.
There is.
You know, yay, you got away with all this stealing, all this stuff. But there must be other people in the community who would say, man, you that's not righteous, you know?
There may be some of that that comes from family members, from parents, from friends.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also,
I mean, if the concepts you're talking about could be worked through the community that includes activity that's not apprehended,
That's a whole other program, Chuck, that we could talk about actually in terms of how to. Galvanize and bring to life the great values in neighborhoods and communities, again, using the gifts of the spirit.
Right.
You know, the organizational development specialists and those tied to the research will never use the phrase gifts of the spirit, but I know what they are. And they may utilize other phrases and terms to try to say, here's how we're going to build the, they'll say social fabric, or they'll say the strength or whatever. But there's a whole other genre out there of how to build neighborhoods. And by the way, the police can be highly engaged in activating neighborhoods so that there's a higher level of friendliness, care, support, looking out after. That's another role that I haven't talked about in terms of what police can do in any community. Because what's safer, a community that's that way or a community that has more armed guards in it? And our experience shows that those strong neighborhoods have, they're much more resilient towards any kinds of crime or disorder. So there's a lot of things out there that we could talk about, but in terms of going back into these communities, I will tell you that sometimes they go back into communities that will say, hey, they'll high five the guy who did it.
Right.
Or they'll go back into their gang. They'll go back into their gang and say, here's what we did. Well, yeah, all right. You could have gotten more, but we'll take what you did. I mean, there's all those dynamics out there. You just don't know what they're walking back into. So
I think the power is being directly faced by your victim. You know, that's the power of it, to see the harm you cause. Oftentimes the criminal justice system takes that possibility off the table. They just get tangled up in this whole system, and the victim and the criminal never have a chance to interface in a real way, in a meaningful
You're
way.
Right.
And so,
you're right, Paul. And
yeah.
Very non-personal, done by the professionals. It's a crime against the state. The right to remain silent, a sacred right. You don't have to choose accountability. You don't have to say a word, in fact. And that's the nature of our criminal justice system, right, mm-hmm. wrong, or indifferent. Are there better ways where you can get accountability, where victims can have an opportunity to heal, where communities can also heal and be made whole? The criminal justice system doesn't really speak to those things. And so it's very impersonal. Like I said, a crime against the state. Lawyers speak to each other. And victims and offenders are kind of left out of it. And so it's very non-personal.
So, Marvin, you had something you were holding on to that you wanted to mention?
This has been such an interesting conversation. one of the most interesting conversations I think we've had for a while. I mean, we have great conversations here in the program, but this has been great, Mike. It's such a complex subject. You know, I mean, just for one thing, you know, just what we were just talking about, the effect on communities of these petty crimes that have been defined as below the level of crime so that they, you know, they don't get touched. Does that affect the community? Well, I think it does, because part of what happens is when the culture of the surrounding community drops down below a certain level and crime is allowed and even, you know, sort of celebrated as culture war on some level, then businesses, you know, realize they can't function there. They begin to pull out, and you have these communities that, what they call them, sort of desert, financially, they're desert communities. The businesses pull out and the whole community suffers because the businesses can't function there because of the level of deterioration of the cultural values that are going on. So you can't leave it unaddressed. The community itself suffers. And I think the wiser leadership of those communities recognizes that, and that they have to maintain a higher level of values. But there's lots, so many things that flow into and out of this. I was just thinking about the situation with Jude and how Jesus dealt with that.
Right,
and,
right.
And how, you know, what we're talking about cultures and how cultures define themselves and what they do to deal with their erring members. And the example of Jude just comes so much to mind. And there are two paragraphs that I found that seem related. On 128:7-4,
they say this: Jesus was a man of peace, and ever and anon was he embarrassed by Jude's belligerent exploits and numerous patriotic outbursts. And this I found interesting. James and Joseph were in favor of casting him out, but
right.
Jesus would not consent. When their patience would be severely tried, Jesus would only counsel, "Be patient, be wise in your counsel and eloquent in your lives, that your young brother may first know the better way and then be constrained to follow you in it." The wise and loving counsel of Jesus prevented a break in the family, and they remained together. And then a few paragraphs down below, they say, Jesus spent a great deal of time this year with the individual members of his family. He would take them for long and frequent strolls up the hill and through the countryside. Before harvest, he took Jude to the farmer uncle south of Nazareth, but Jude did not remain long after the harvest. He ran away, and Simon later found him with the fishermen at the lake. When Simon brought him back home, Jesus talked things over with the runaway lad, and since he wanted to be a fisherman, went over to Magdala with him and put him in the care of a relative, a fisherman. And Jude worked fairly well and regularly from that time on until his marriage, and he continued as a fisherman after his marriage. And those principles, like a community is like a family, right? I mean, either, you know, the retributive justice basically says, you're no longer a family member, we're kicking you out, you go wander in the desert. You know, you're not a part of us anymore. And the restorative justice says, no, we need to work with you, even though you're a challenging member of the community, we need to work with you and help you find a way forward where you can be part of us and honored and you know, you can find value and feel good about yourself. And the beauty of how Jesus did that with Jude is a wonderful example, until he finally found a way for Jude to settle in and socialize, you know, appropriately. The other thing that I wanted to throw out there is, you know, the other example is Judas, you know, who Jesus tried
right.
over and over and over to rehabilitate, and through his poor choices.
Mm-hmm.
Judas never came around, you know, never did, or as far as we know. We don't really know ultimately, but seems like he that effort failed. So it's like we're in this world, you know, we have to do the best we can with this restorative effort and really treat our communities, you know, on some level as family ventures, larger family ventures spiritually, and see people who err as our erring sisters and brothers who need to be helped to find a way to you know, turn around and walk right. But it's an evolutionary realm, and there's no guarantee of success. We just have to simply do the best we can, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So I think all those things are at play in the effort to shift to restorative principles. It's just like, I gotta say that I salute you and really admire your work on the front lines. In this mm-hmm. effort, I think it's heroic work.
It is heroic.
Yeah, and I think it's expressive of the gospel. You know, it's living out the gospel on the front lines.
You know, had a long conversation with somebody you all know, Terry Kruger, yesterday. We spent several hours talking about a lot of things And what we're eventually after here on this planet is brotherhood and sisterhood, spiritual brotherhood, understanding that we're spiritual brothers and sisters. And that's what we're after. You know, between here and there, there's going to be a lot of small steps, and maybe occasionally we'll be able to accelerate the ball down the evolutionary track a little bit, but this is just one of those small steps towards a sense of, this is how I see it. Us having more compassion, caring, bearing each other's burdens, and, you know, attending to the gifts and capacities of everybody else. And and kind of bringing those gifts of those people who kind of live in the margins and live in the shadows into the center. And that's love. And and that's where we, that's restorative. And, you know, and I keep on saying the gifts of the spirit, and that's what we're talking about here. These are in our midst. They're all around us. And so, you know, conducing us all to brotherhood is what we're all after. But I love those examples, Marvin. They're wonderful. And I remember reading those and saying the same thing. And, you know, Jesus didn't act like a brother. He acted like a father. And fatherly love is a little bit different than brotherly love sometimes. And he, you know, and, you know, brothers and or fathers and mothers typically don't, they want to do what they can to, you know, help their children find a more productive, caring, you know, path in their lives if they have gone wayward. And so, so anyway, great example.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have always thought that restorative justice was, and you've so helped me, Mike, because I now understand it so much better, as an opportunity to help keep people out of the criminal justice system. And I just think that never occurred to me, and it is wonderful. I'm so encouraged to hear this, because I've seen what the criminal justice system can do to people and to families.
Yes.
And it's strong medicine. Boy, is it strong medicine. And this idea of recidivism and this idea of institutionalization, which is something people seldom think about, but once a man or a woman has been in prison for, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, their chance of making it on the outside, it gets smaller and smaller because they become institutionalized. And this happens even in the military. I mean, they just don't know how to make it on the outside anymore. And that's a whole other problem.
It is.
Go ahead.
Let me just say this whole reentry part. We're working with, for lack of a better term, reentry specialists. It's ongoing right now in our community with restored principles and practices around how to help people reintegrate back into the community.
Wow.
And they reached out to the restorative, they reached out to us in terms of wanting to use these principles and practices to help people reintegrate coming out of prison. And so there's another example. It has something to do with the criminal justice system, but it's another example of someone who's wounded. How many people do we run into that are feeling the sense of unworthiness, the sense of feeling wounded, the sense of shame, the sense of not knowing if they belong? And by the way, the whole belonging piece is so critically important. If what Jesus did so wonderfully is he let people know that they belonged. They belong to the universe. They belong to the community. They belong to where they were at. It made them feel good. And that sense of belonging is, there's the whole thing of belong to something. It's relational. There's this whole thing of something belongs to me. And when something belongs to you, like a community or a family or a neighborhood, you're more likely to take care of it. You're more likely to become a co-creator or an investment,
and
value it in terms of, and so this whole idea of belonging is critical for people. You can probably call it something else, but or a myriad of other kinds of terms for this. But that whole lot, the whole dynamic of belonging, a lot of people just don't. They wonder and they don't feel like they belong, and
right.
So. And when you restore, you help people's sense of belonging. And sometimes, you know, what I didn't say in the restorative justice process is oftentimes the victims and offenders will bring in their support groups. And there could be families, friends, school associates, business associates, whoever. Sometimes it can be a lot of people. And in many instances, going back to your point, Chuck, these folks they feel like you committed a harm against what you belong to here. And now we want to amend and kind of repair that harm, and because we want you to belong to us, whether it's the family or whether it's the community or friends or our high school. And that restorative process does that. That's one of the principles, is the reintegration is part of that. And so it's just it's an amazing, powerful way of healing, helping the healing process in so many different ways.
Yeah. It's very interesting, Mike. You know, you're bringing up the relational aspect of things. And that's a key part of, from what I understand, that restorative justice and restorative practices were harkening back to in some of the practices of indigenous peoples of North America.
Exactly.
And and in fact, also of the Maori of New Zealand that also had those practices. And this has all been an evolution in bringing this into our culture since the 70s, I understand. Is that right?
You know, you might be right around the formality of restorative justice in this country, but you're also right about indigenous cultures, you know, the stories of if someone did something wrong, they put them in the center of the community, and they said, here's what we love about you. They actually, the goodness and love that that person felt probably crowded out the stuff that they were had in them that caused the behavior in the first place. There was a recognition there that powerful, but you're right. It started, and it may have even started in some other cultures along the way over time, but the first recorded or first known are in these indigenous cultures. And when it was introduced into the United States, I don't quite remember. I can tell you we introduced it in Longmont, 1996. So it's been ongoing for 25-plus years here. So.
Wow. Right, yeah.
Anyway,
I mean, I'm not saying
right,
it gained
though,
a lot of
right
traction in the 70s, but it certainly, it you know, the people that noticed it and started studying it, it takes a long time for things to filter into culture. What's interesting as well is in the restorative justice aspect, some of these are still, I mean, it's still looked at, quote unquote, as punishment, you know, but the punishment is fitting the crime. It's the idea we're not getting rid of any kind of punishment, but the punishment actually fits. It actually is designed to do some good. They're not going to escape punishment. But if for those that are looking for punishment, those that are looking for, you know, quote unquote, the pound of flesh isn't a pound of flesh anymore. It's something that will actually do good and stop, you know, the recidivism and stop the,
exactly.
the cycle.
Help them understand the harm they committed, and here are the residuals. And I don't necessarily use the word punishment. I know that word is used in the Urantia papers. I tend to kind of go with consequences. And the term consequences is that someone has to be accountable for making something happen that's going to help them understand and help them kind of bond with the person they harmed more. And so that's exactly what we try to do in every single one of these cases. Sometimes we have to get pretty creative, but we find that versus, okay, here's a fine or here's a jail sentence or here's both, you know, that one size fits all approach. And, you know, the other thing that I think what restorative practices offers is the whole, you drill down through all the factors and everything that's going on in someone's life. It's not just this one act. You're also now exposed, and you're also dealing with a lot of other related variables I believe that, you know, the Ancients of Days and our celestial society friends have a lot more awareness about when it comes to us mere mortals than just seeing us or the act that we committed. And right. And so and the criminal justice system kind of defines the act. Here's the law you violated. And sometimes the sentencing or something that's brought out, but by then it's way too late. But the restorative process brings in a lot more variables about the complexity of the human, of the people that are part of it. And those all become part of the conversation.
You know, what occurs to me, Mike, and what you're saying, and Andre and Mike, just and Chuck too, just all of us really, Paula. you mentioned that you can ask the question, what is the end result, or you know, what's of this effort, and I think you can sort of put side by side the two different approaches, one of, let's call it criminal justice, and the other of the therapeutic or helping professions. And I think part of what happened, and I think you're right, Andre, is back in the 70s, is people began to look at how the helping professions could interact with the judicial system more and more and more. As a result of dealing with these social problems and the larger question of, you know, what are we trying to accomplish here in this whole endeavor began to be asked, I'm guessing. And the interesting, I think, what you arrive at, and I hear you sort of trying to get to this, Mike, with the way you're describing this, is the end result is not a punishment or even a set of consequences. The end result that you're looking for is what I would call a healing structure.
Restoration.
Yeah, restoration.
It's restoration.
But it has to be structured. It has to be coherent. It has to have stability and solidity.
Right.
And its end result is to make something that was broken, make it whole again.
Right.
You know, so the whole idea of the end result is what you're after is a really effective healing structure out of this whole process.
I wonder if we could go back to the idea of belonging in the context of what you're saying there, Marvin. Mike, I'm so glad you brought that up. I think that's so crucial and so important. And there's one reference in the book, I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but where the authors speak to this in a very interesting way. This is in 8773. I'll just pull
that's
out the
exactly
sentence in the middle.
Right.
Yeah.
Bingo.
It's regrettable
bingo.
That so many.
Yeah.
What
well, you could read 29 as well.
Well, let me just read this one sentence first. They say, it is regrettable that so many modern believers in moral standards and spiritual ideals have no adequate symbolism, nothing to belong to. And that's kind
right.
of putting it on the other side of the picture. So when I think about these people who engage in this kind of, we could call it petty crime, but as you pointed out, it does do real damage, and are not apprehended, they just go back to their communities, and maybe they actually get a sense of belonging from what they've done,
right.
actually.
Yeah.
But
gangs can help
side,
with that, by the way. Right.
What, gangs, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, right, exactly. And from their perspective, when they look at society at large, what they see probably is just a bunch of people who are all out for themselves, even in the organized society, whatever you want to call it, because of this thing that's missing that the book is talking about here. So if there's, and in a way, that's almost what Jesus was saying with Jude, you know, to the siblings, you know, here, demonstrate our family standards, live out the standards of our family in a positive way so that Jude can see that and want to belong to our family because
right.
it's demonstrating something that is attractive and appealing. Even though he may not see that in the moment, at least there's a chance of that developing over time. And I think this, the appeal of belonging, I mean, it's, you know, we all know the culture in America right now is all over the map. It's not clear where to focus our desire for belonging. You know, there's so much division and so much just individuals just getting what they can for themselves. If that's the standard of the community at large, then these people who go in, smash and grab or whatever, they're in their own way, they're just sort of acting out what they see as the standard at large. Even if in the enlarged picture, it's more organized and it's kind of structured in a way. But in terms of having, what do they say here, spiritual ideals, moral standards and spiritual ideals, there's no symbolism representing that. If it's not clear in the culture what those moral ideals and spiritual ideals and moral standards are, then it's hard to cultivate the desire to belong to that. Instead,
well, and that's
it's probably more just being applauded by, oh, man, you got one of those? You got a new one? You know, you got an iPad? Wow. You know,
right, right. Or Nikes. But I just want to add something to this idea of belonging, Chuck, because this is so important to me, too. I think it's a basic human need. I think we all need to be forgiven because we all make mistakes. We all need, of course, to be loved. We all need to be understood. We all need to, you know, belong to something. That's such a fundamental human need. We need to belong. We need to feel like we are a part of something greater than ourselves. We need to feel like we belong. And I think part of the problems with some of the crime we've seen, especially with young people, like I think of Klebold and Harris, who did the Columbine Massacre. And I don't think of them totally as monsters. I think of them as victims, too. They were victims in the sense that they didn't feel like they belonged. And we see a lot of the crimes in high schools are caused by that. And things like Challenge Day really help teenagers understand that very basic human principle of wanting to belong and wanting to be understood and accepted. That's it. That's another big one. We want to be accepted, warts and all. Because none of us are perfect. And so those are such fundamental human needs, and I'm so glad you brought that up because I think it looms large, not only in restoration, but also in prevention of crime. If people could get a handle more on these basic human needs to keep kids, because that's where it starts. Young people are the ones that get into gangs, you know, because they don't feel like they belong anywhere else. Mm-hmm. The gangs make them feel like they belong. And
it's
so
it's a place
is pretty
of safety for them, too. Sometimes
it's what,
because their own homes are not safe.
Right, right.
You know, I want to say a couple things. Number one, the violence issue. The vast majority of violence that occurs either between or amongst people who know each other, or people who allegedly love each other, and there is stranger violence, but it's much more rare, and that's a dynamic that a lot of people don't think about when it comes to violence. And so, when people would ask me, "Is it safe to live in Longmont?" my pet response was always, it depends who you live with. And because that's where the vast majority of our violence occurred. And, and in all communities, that's where sex assaults occur in families, that's where domestic violence occurs.
Murder.
homicides occur, crimes of passion. You know, there is gang violence, but all these folks know each other. There is stranger violence, but it's rare. And statistically, that's what plays out. Now, the one thing I want to really I want to drive home here a little bit, and I'm just going to start off with this statement, and that is, for every bad thing that happens in a community, there's at least 1,000 good things that happen.
Wow.
We don't necessarily recognize those because they're not put in front of us or not mediaized anywhere near as much, whether they're in families, whether they're with friends, whether they're neighbors, whether it's strangers with strangers. You know, I knew more what was going on that wasn't going well in Longmont than anybody else for years. But I was so much a part of this community, I was virtually overwhelmed by what was going on that was good. And so part of your whole restorative process is to leverage what's good. And the change model, like I was talking about earlier, was we need to go from, I mean, we've always tried to change things by looking at things as, and this is what the criminal justice system does. They look at people as a problem to be solved. The restorative justice process looks at people as a possibility. And the same, we do the same thing with communities. We see them as problems to be solved. We don't see them as possibilities. We see the criminal justice system sees people through the lens of their deficiencies. The restorative justice process sees them through the lens of goodness. And there's no question in my mind that that whole aspect of goodness and leveraging it, and you can change people, you can change organizations, you can change communities, you can change countries by acknowledging what's good and expanding that to the point where it begins to crowd out the kind of behavior we don't want to see, versus trying to say, here's what's deficient, we're going to try to eliminate that, or here's your problem, your problem to be fixed. That's an old model that I think has caused, that's what has happened, and that's what creates the recidivism that we have. And what creates, I think, a lot safer community and or different organizations or different even people. And that's what Jesus did. Jesus acknowledged the goodness that existed inside of people and went from there in terms of how we help that person understand that that is part of who they are. They have that strength. They have that wisdom. They have that goodness. And he built on that. And we brought out the Old Testament stuff. He never criticized what was not true as much as he emphasized what was true. And so that's how he taught. And so I think that's, those are just great lessons. Those are just great lessons for us. And if we want to figure out how to modify, shift, change, transform, you can't legislate or force transformation. People have to choose it. And the best way for them to choose it, I believe, is for them to acknowledge that they have the capacity and goodness to do it. And that's where I think we're going to end up eventually. We have to end up eventually. The restorative principles and practices models are, a fragment of all of that. But it basically resides in the whole thinking that there's something good and possible in the person that we're dealing with here that we're going to bring out, emphasize, and hopefully that person will begin to recognize that they have possibilities, they have goodness. And those are the things that sustain accountability, not forcing it or legislating it or seeing it as, I mean, face it, if all of us have had kids, we walked into a classroom and teacher said, your kid is a problem to be solved, that's an entirely different conversation than your kid is a possibility. And so that's where restorative practices go.
Yeah. There's a principle, and I go back to this, Mike, and I do think it probably began in the 70s and 80s, is the beginning to mutually affect each other, the disciplines of therapy and in the judicial system. There was a huge change around the same time. I think it began in the 60s and 70s in the field of therapy. And that was a big shift in therapeutic approaches between what used to be called and understood as problem-focused approaches and a huge shift toward what came to be understood as solution-oriented therapies. Which exactly parallels what you're talking about, which is, I think, a profound spiritual principle that Jesus did act out in all of his life and his ministry. And that was the therapeutic approaches, instead of focusing on understanding and delving deeper into what was wrong, and problematic histories, et cetera, began to leave all of that alone. And began to focus on where were the areas in a person's life that things were developing well and that where there were successes, and how do you expand on those and grow those parts of a person's experience? And that began to be the focus of solution-oriented therapies. Where were there positive differences, and how could you proliferate them and multiply them, find areas of success, function? And I think there's a principle at work here
that taps into the way the universe is structured and the way God works. Yeah, and so I think when you do that, you're tapping into a spiritual source of power that will actually work and that engenders a sense of hope for people and a sense of, you know, we can be effective at making this happen well and bring wholeness and satisfaction and a sense of belonging. And I think where I think, you know, the section that Chuck was talking about, which, you know, we've talked about this many times, is it's in the section that talks about symbolism in cult and culture. And where they're going with that is the model of wholeness and restoration and healing is one of spiritual family function that is the underlying paradise value, I think, that runs throughout all creation, which is the ideal that Jesus was trying to show us, is that we're all part of something much larger. And so the question becomes, you know, in these restorative efforts, what am I part of and how do we make that happen in a real way? What do I belong to? What am I part of? What is the larger whole that I'm trying to participate in this life? And I frankly think it's an issue that's much larger than simply restorative justice. It's an issue of where our world is going in terms of society and civilization as a whole, and issues that are vast, like, you know, climate issues and issues of peace and issues of economic parity, you know, economic justice in a larger sense globally. All root back to this same set of issues of what are we part of, what do we belong to, what's the larger reality spiritually that's unfolding here, and how do we tap into it and make it happen in our relationships? And I think that the cultural symbolism here is one of spiritual family. I think that's what Jesus was pointing to, is, you know, how do we change the way we are? Let's change how we understand what we're part of and how we function within that, you know, to heal and to make whole. Yeah.
Let's face it, the whole universe is trying to restore us.
Yeah.
The whole universe is engaged in restoring us to the universe. So, but go ahead, Chuck, sorry.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that the companion concept, or the concept that goes along with belonging, is loyalty. And loyalty is a key issue in all of this, I think, you know, where people put their loyalties. So if you belong to something, some kind of group that you can identify with, then you become loyal to that group and you become loyal to its values and ideals, such as they may be. So the development or articulation or whatever you want to call it of the values that inspire loyalty is crucial, I think, to belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And that can, of course, cut both ways. But they make this interesting comment about Judas, that his sense of values and loyalties was defective. So that's kind of what he was trapped between, being loyal to Jesus and the apostles and being loyal to his Judean friends, who were prone to ridiculing what he was doing.
Sure.
And
that
he
peer
was
pressure.
Caught, even though he was faithful in the discharge of all his duties, so he never did anything that could really be called out as a, you know, as a violation or something like that. Within himself, he was divided in this way. And that's what ultimately drove him to make the decisions he did.
His crime was cosmic. He really committed no crime in terms of as crime goes, and Jesus didn't either. You know, that's the irony of it. Jesus didn't commit a crime either, and Judas didn't commit a crime as law sees it, and yet his crime was cosmic, you know.
But what I wanted to say about this in terms of restorative justice is the promise in what you're describing, Mike, is that it will rejuvenate or restore a sense of loyalty, potentially. You know, loyalty to the community, loyalty
it does.
To the...
It loyalty to themselves in terms of their own desires to be a better person, loyalty to their families, loyalty to the community, loyalty to the victim. You're right on, Chuck, with that whole these I keep on calling them gifts of the spirit, but we're recognizing these gifts that are part of this, and we can keep going and keep on talking about a lot more of that. But, and then you said it so well too, Marvin, in terms of, you know, the principles are the same, whether we're talking at a local level with restorative process or restorative principles and practices, or whether we're talking, you know, a system with 1,000 inhabited planets, the principles are going to be the same. And so someone asked earlier, did we tap into the Urantia kind of a revelation? There's no question that that's where a lot of this motivation to try to figure out something different came from. So,
wow.
Well, and you begin to open it up. You know, we haven't really gone there yet, but it's obviously related, is issues of justice and what you're loyal to, and the problems of our society and our culture really go back to the whole Lucifer rebellion and Lucifer's denial of loyalty to the larger whole of the universe as God has created it, and establishing his own small power base. And in a certain sense, what was going on with Jesus and the scribes and the Pharisees, I sort of look at the scribes and the Pharisees as institutionalized criminals. I mean, they were living off the system at the expense of the welfare of the whole, right? Which was a very Luciferian way to understand it. They were protecting their own small power base. You know, in the largest sense, the whole Lucifer rebellion and how it's working out is an issue of restorative justice. You know, we're all part of this process of trying to make, in the largest sense, the cosmic community, to make it whole, to heal it. And we're in the middle of it still on this planet. And the challenges we face are these really broad, large issues that are working out globally, and they're working out in our communities. And the principles of restoration and making things whole in the way they need to be are functioning on the smallest level and on the largest level as well. They're playing out.
You know, and at some level too, Marvin, we're also talking about trying to align the will, our will, and maybe the will of a community or the will of a planet with God's will. And this is all part of that. And so at least that's how I see it. And so it's complex, but it doesn't have to be overly complex.
Yeah, good point. Well, and we're down to the last 12 minutes, and I just want to ask you, because we haven't 10 minutes. Okay. Thanks, Andre. We haven't touched on it yet. What does this do, this restorative justice process, do for victims? You mentioned it a little bit, but I would love to hear because the victim is, you know, the one that the crime has been perpetrated against the victim, and they've been hurt at various levels, some severely and some not so bad. But what does this do for them when they go through this process?
Well, you see, that's the forgotten part of the criminal justice system, too, by the way. Victims are very, very, they have a very small voice in what goes on, because it's a crime against the state. And what restorative practices emphasizes is that the voice of the victim becomes the centerpiece. And oftentimes victims feel like they've been violated. They feel less secure. They feel less safe. Their sense of their own being has been dinged, has been nicked, has been penetrated, and their sense of vulnerability around their own lives goes in a lot of different directions, and it's unhealthy for them. They know it's unhealthy. And so And there's a lot of crimes where that happens. And you'd be surprised. Someone broke into my car. Well, that's, but it's amazing how many times we've heard, I feel like I've been violated. That's the phrase they come up with.
Yeah.
And so the restorative process is all about restoring victim too. And it's about, we spend a lot of time with the folks who've been victimized prior to the conference, prior to putting them in the conference with the offender and everybody else. And so we do a lot of work with them prior to that and guide them and coach them and basically get their feedback about what they need in this whole process. And I will tell you, I'll jump to a conclusion here real quickly. Victim satisfaction rates were like 97-98% in the restorative justice process, year after year after year after year, because they realized their voice counted, their thoughts mattered, and maybe most importantly, that their humanness was now being valued. And that those things are very healing for people who have been violated, who have been made vulnerable by an act of somebody else. And because it's like you begin to fear other people even. We've talked to many victims over the years where, you know, they feel like there's a bad person behind every tree now or something.
Right.
That's just, anyway, it's they have this sense of unhealthy vulnerability going for them. And so when they realize that their voice means something, that their thoughts are valued, and like I said, most importantly, their beings, their humanness is really appreciated. Those things in and of themselves are very healing for people who don't belong, feel they belong, for people who've been victimized by crimes, for people who have had wounds in their lives from some source, to know that that's real for them is very healing. And so we make a space for people. And the one thing that I don't think I mentioned was we actually started, it was a very restorative principle process here in Longmont, something called the Belonging Revolution, where our officers and fire staff, and I did this for, I did it for 5 years almost every Sunday. People asked me what church I went to. I said I went to the Our Lady of the Belonging Revolution because I'm out there on Sunday mornings. And most of the neighborhoods we went into were neighborhoods where people didn't own homes, high-density housing, apartment complexes, mobile home parks. And our goal with the Belonging Revolution was to encourage people to feel and believe they belong. Again, another role police can play in a community that, you know, we have to figure out how to build trust. We have to be more transparent. We have to be more accountable. Well, really what police need to do is to figure out how they can become more a part of the community. And people get to know them. And people get to like your dad. And so this whole, it is very healing for the victim. We can't say that they're perfectly healed. There are some that say, I need more work. I'm seeing a treatment provider. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a therapist, I'm part of we have a victims advocate group within public safety here in Longmont that they can work with on the dynamics of what it's like to be a victim and how to heal. So we pay a tremendous amount of attention to that, whereas the criminal justice system kind of throws the victim aside. And maybe there's a victim impact statement before the sentencing. But it's very formal and it's very kind of, it's couched in the context of a very suspect offender-oriented process.
Right.
And so, but I also want to bring up that Belonging Revolution piece. It's amazing. I mean, I could go into another whole hour. I won't. We don't have time. But a whole other of what happens to people. when you show up on their driveway or their front lawn, sometimes invited in their living rooms, and for the first time, maybe, I mean, it can't tell me how many times we've heard someone values what I think. And then we get it to that point where we would ask, we would make an invitation to them, would you like to become more involved in our community? Because we have lots of things we need to do. And what we discovered is that not only do people have gifts, they want to offer those gifts. That is huge. And it's very underestimated and very dormant in every community. And we're talking neighborhoods where people don't own homes, but for the most part, they don't own property. And it was amazing how enthusiastic they became when they said, I know I only got a couple of minutes here, but I want to give you one story real quick. My partner Dan and I were walking down the street. We recognized a guy who was sitting on a patio. No one was off limits. We approached everybody. We didn't knock on doors. We just approached everybody. And he was sitting on this, and didn't have a shirt on. It was summertime, and he was tattooed from his waist to his forehead. We walked up. I introduced myself. I'm public safety chief, and Dan was a former Tim, and he puts his hands up in the air like he's being arrested. He says, out of the interest of full disclosure, I'm going to tell you, chief, all your guys know me. I've been in jail. I'm struggling with addiction. I'm shortening the story. I'm living in with my mom. I'm lost. I have no idea, and I'm trying to figure out life. And that was his story. I mean, and he went on. And we finally calmed it all down, and we got to the end where we said, you know, I'll just give you his first name. It was Ryan. Ryan, would you like to become more involved in our community, engaged in doing some things? You know, we were all in tears because Ryan was tears coming down his face because of how valued he felt. Because up until then, he was scum. He was shamed. And now, you know, it was just that I can't tell you how many experiences we had like that, mm-hmm. that where people just felt appreciated. They felt like they belonged. And so that's a whole other thing to talk about another day, but I know we're done here. So.
He was ready to be arrested. And you.
Well, he probably did do something wrong, but we didn't go there. we didn't do anything with that. We just basically you kind of affirmed that he had value and that he had something to offer the rest of us. And that was the nature of
our story.
So,
that's wonderful. That's the prodigal son story right there. I mean, that's, you know, here's my son, you know, who has value.
He was the lost sheep, you know, the one in the 100, whoever.
Right. Well, gosh, thank you, Mike. Thank you so much. You know, I just love hearing what you had to say, and I learned so much from you, and I'm so grateful, and I know we all are, and it was wonderful having you on, and I'd love to have you come back again and talk to us about some other things you're passionate about.
Well, I feel grateful to belong to and have connections and relationships with you. Andre, Chuck, I don't know you, but I spent some time with Marvin, and I've enjoyed that, and my life has been enriched because of you're in it, and thank you.
Yeah,
and I feel like
ditto.
I belong to that aspect of that community, and it feels good. So
yeah.
It's great to hear about.
What a wonderful, it's just a wonderful conversation, Mike. And you know, it really would be great to have you come back and talk some more about this with us.
So important. It's so basic. Chuck, were you going to say something?
Nope, just that. Just want to say big shout out
just
thank you to Mike.
Yeah, and also when you're talking to our buddy Terry Kruger again, give him our love.
Yeah.
Tell him we miss
him.
I
do. Terry
okay,
and I, we live 6 minutes apart from each other, and we're going to get together more and more often.
Yay.
I've learned so much from him,
He's
as
awesome.
I've learned from all of you too. So. There's amazing amounts of wisdom. So, thank you.
Yeah, we're blessed.
I'd rather.
It's good to know you're on the job.
All of this restoration is something down here, but I bet you it's going on those early mansion worlds as well.
Oh,
so
without
I think
a doubt.
You're doing
you're just beginning it here.
That's right.
Well, thanks
I wish the authors, I don't know who the author of those papers were, but they somehow there was a line around where we're eliminating deficiencies.
There you go.
Versus saying we are expanding. Maybe when I get up there, I'll understand no more, and maybe the deficiency word will be more of my word. But right now, I'm more into emphasizing goodness. So.
There you
go.
Truly Jesusonian attitude. Yeah. Well, thanks, you guys. We've run out of time, but we got it all in,
all right.
Except for maybe three words at the end there, Mike. And we sure appreciate having you on. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much, Mike. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Andre. We'll see everybody soon.
Okay.
All righty.
Sounds good.
And God bless you, Andre, Marvin, and Chuck.
We'll be off for Christmas. We won't have a Christmas Day show. But we should be back
next week.
New Year's Day, right, guys? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. We've got to talk about what we want to talk about.
Well, right. I'm going to suggest we go to marriage and family life as a segue to this that would actually begin to talk about some of the preventative aspects, the restorative practices.
Well, I'm down with that.
Yeah.
Yay. Okay.
And see how we got to
Hope the holidays are a time of spiritual restoration for all of us too. Just enjoy family and be spiritually renewed.
Sure will be.
Thank you. Love you guys.
Okay, see everybody
thanks,
in 2 weeks.
I love you all.
Thank you, Mike.
And we'll talk soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. God bless.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.